It wasn't that he had anything against Catholics. Well, bar the reflexes inbred by a life spent as a Protestant in the Highlands. But he just couldn't see it. Going over to Rome was how Mrs. Ogilvy and Mrs. McNeil and all the rest of them would see it. Going straight to the bad place being the unspoken implication. His defection would be discussed in tones of low horror for, well, for years. He grinned reluctantly at the thought. Well, and besides, he couldn't be a Catholic priest now, could he? Not with Bree and the kids. That made him feel a little calmer, and he sat down again. No, he'd have to trust that God, through the agency of Dr. Weatherspoon, proposed to show him the way through this particular thorny passage of his life. And if he did, well, was that not evidence of predestination in itself? Roger groaned, thrust the whole thing out of his head, and immersed himself doggedly in his notebook. Some of the songs and poems he'd written down were well known, selections from his previous life, traditional songs he'd sung as a performer. Many of the rare ones he'd acquired during the 18th century from Scottish immigrants, travellers, peddlers, and seamen. And some he'd unearthed from the trove of boxes the Reverend had left behind. The garage of the old manse had been filled with them, and he and Bree had made no more than a dent in it. Pure luck that he'd run across the wooden box of letters so soon after their return. He glanced up at it, tempted. He couldn't read the letters without Bree, that wouldn't be right. But the two books. They'd looked briefly at the books when they'd found the box, but had been concerned mostly with the letters and with finding out what had happened to Claire and Jamie. Feeling like Jem, absconding with a packet of chocolate biscuits, he brought the box down carefully. It was very heavy, and set it on the desk, rummaging carefully down under the letters. The books were small, the largest, what was called a Crown Octavo volume, about 5 by 7 inches. It was a common size, from a time when paper was expensive and difficult to get. The smaller was likely a Crown Sixteenmo, only about 4 by 5 inches. He smiled briefly, thinking of Ian Murray. Brianna had told him her cousin's scandalized response to her description of toilet paper. He might never wipe his arse again without a feeling of extravagance. The small one was carefully bound in blue-dyed calfskin with gilt-edged pages, an expensive, beautiful book. Pocket Principles of Health, it was entitled, by C.E.B. F. Fraser, M.D. A limited edition, produced by A. Bell, printer, Edinburgh. That gave him a small thrill. So they'd made it to Scotland under the care of Captain Trustworthy Roberts. Or at least he supposed they must. Though the scholar in him cautioned that this wasn't proof. It was always possible that the manuscript had somehow made it to Scotland without necessarily being carried in person by the author. Had they come here? He wondered. He looked around the worn, comfortable room, easily envisioning Jamie at the big old desk by the window, going through the farm ledgers with his brother-in-law. If the kitchen was the heart of the house, and it was, this room had likely always been its brain. Moved by impulse, he opened the book and nearly choked. The frontispiece, in customary 18th-century style, showed an engraving of the author. A medical man in a neat tie wig and black coat, with a high black stock. From above which his mother-in-law's face looked serenely out at him. He laughed out loud, causing Annie Mac to peer cautiously in at him in case he might be having a fit of some kind, as well as talking to himself. He waved her off and shut the door before returning to the book. It was her, all right. The wide-spaced eyes under dark brows, the graceful firm bones of cheek, temple, and jaw. Whoever had done the engraving had not got her mouth quite right. It had a sterner shape here, and a good thing, too. No man had lips like hers. How old? He checked the date of printing. MD CC L XX V II. 1778. Not much older than when he'd last seen her then, and still looking a good deal younger than he knew her to be. Was there a picture of Jamie in the other? He seized it and flipped it open. Sure enough, another steel-point engraving, though this was a more homely drawing. His father-in-law sat in a wing chair, his hair tied simply back, a plaid draped over the chair behind him, and a book open upon his knee. He was reading to a small child sitting upon his other knee, a little girl with dark curly hair. She was turned away, absorbed in the story. Of course, the engraver couldn't have known what Mandy's face would look like. Grandfather Tales, the book was titled, with the subtitle Stories from the Highlands of Scotland and the Back Country of the Carolinas, by James Alexander Malcolm Mackenzie Fraser. Again, printed by A. Bell, Edinburgh, in the same year. The dedication said simply, "For my grandchildren." Claire's portrait had made him laugh. This one moved him almost to tears, and he closed the book gently. Such faith they had had, to create, to hoard, to send these things, these fragile documents, down through the years, with only the hope that they would survive and reach those for whom they were intended. Faith that Mandy would be here to read them one day. He swallowed, the lump in his throat painful. How had they managed it? Well, they did say faith moved mountains, even if his own seemed presently not adequate to flatten a molehill. Jesus, he muttered, not sure if this was simple frustration or a prayer for assistance. A flicker of motion through the window distracted him from the paper, and he glanced up to see Jem coming out of the kitchen door at the far end of the house. He was red in the face, small shoulders hunched, and had a large string bag in one hand, through which Roger could see a bottle of lemon squash, a loaf of bread, and a few other food-like bulges. Startled, Roger looked at the clock on the mantel, thinking he had lost complete track of time. But he hadn't. It was just on 1 o'clock.
What the?
Shoving the paper aside, he got up and made for the back of the house, emerging just in time to see Jem's small figure, clad in wind cheetah and jeans, he wasn't allowed to wear jeans to school, making its way across the hayfield. Roger could have caught him up easily, but instead slowed his pace, following at a distance. Plainly, Jem wasn't ill, so likely something drastic had happened at school. Had the school sent him home, or had he simply left on his own? No one had called, but it was just past the school's dinner hour. If Jem had seized the opportunity to run for it, it was possible they hadn't yet missed him. It was nearly 2 miles to walk, but that was nothing to Jem. Jem had got to the stile in the dry stone dike that walled the field, hopped over, and was making determinedly across a pasture full of sheep. Where was he heading?
And what the bloody hell did you do this time? Roger muttered to himself.
Jem had been in the village school at Brochmorder for only a couple of months, his first experience with 20th-century education. After their return, Roger had tutored Jem at home in Boston while Bree was with Mandy during her recovery from the surgery that had saved her life. With Mandy safe home again, they'd had to decide what to do next. It was mostly Jem that had made them go to Scotland rather than stay in Boston, though Bree had wanted that anyway. It's their heritage, she'd argued. Jem and Mandy are Scots on both sides, after all. I want to keep that for them. And the connection with their grandfather, that went without saying. He'd agreed, and agreed also that Jem would likely be less conspicuous in Scotland. Despite exposure to television and months in the United States, he still spoke with a strong Highland lilt that would make him a marked man in a Boston elementary school. On the other hand, as Roger observed privately, Jem was the sort of person who drew attention, no matter what. Still, there was no question that life on Lallybroch and in a small Highland school
were a great deal more like what a Jim had been accustomed to in North Carolina, though given the natural flexibility of kids, he'd thought he'd adapt pretty well to wherever he found himself. As to his own prospects in Scotland, he'd kept quiet about that. Jem had reached the end of the pasture and shooed off a group of sheep that were blocking the gate that led to the road. A black ram lowered its head and menaced him, but Jem wasn't bothered about sheep. He shouted and swung his bag, and the ram, startled, backed up sharply, making Roger smile. He had no qualms about Jem's intelligence. Well, he did, but not about its lack. Much more about what kind of trouble it could lead him into. School wasn't simple for anyone, let alone a new school. And a school in which one stuck out for any reason. Roger remembered his own school in Inverness, where he was peculiar first for having no real parents, and then as the minister's adopted son. After a few miserable weeks of being poked, taunted, and having his lunch stolen, he'd started hitting back. And while that had led to a certain amount of difficulty with the teachers, it had eventually taken care of the problem. Had Jem been fighting? He hadn't seen any blood, but he might not have been close enough. He'd be surprised if it was that, though. There had been an incident the week before, when Jem had noticed a large rat scurrying into a hole under the school's foundation. He had brought a bit of twine with him next day, set a snare just before going into the first lesson, and gone out at the recess to retrieve his prey, which he had then proceeded to skin in a businesslike manner to the admiration of his male classmates and the horror of the girls. His teacher hadn't been best pleased either. Miss Glendenning was a city woman from Aberdeen. Still, it was a Highland village school, and most of the students came from the nearby farms and crofts. Their fathers fished and hunted, and they certainly understood about rats. The principal, Mr. Mingus, had congratulated Jem on his cunning, but told him not to do it again at school. He had let Jem keep the skin, though. Roger had nailed it ceremoniously to the door of the tool shed. Jem didn't trouble opening the pasture gate, just ducked between the bars, dragging the bag after him. Was he making for the main road, planning to hitchhike? Roger put on a bit of speed, dodging black sheep droppings and kneeing his way through a cluster of grazing ewes, who gave way in indignation, uttering sharp baas. No, Jem had turned the other way. Where the devil could he be going? The dirt lane that led to the main road in one direction led absolutely nowhere in the other. It petered out where the land rose into steep, rocky hills. And that, evidently, was where Jem was headed, for the hills. He turned out of the lane and began climbing, his small form almost obscured by the luxuriant growth of bracken and the drooping branches of rowan trees on the lower slopes. Evidently he was taking to the heather, in the time-honoured manner of Highland outlaws. It was the thought of Highland outlaws that made the penny drop. Jem was heading for the Dunbonnet's cave. Jamie Fraser had lived there for 7 years after the catastrophe of Culloden, almost within sight of his home, but hidden from Cumberland's soldiers, and protected by his tenants, who never used his name aloud, but called him the Dunbonnet, for the colour of the knitted Highland bonnet he wore to conceal his fiery hair. That same hair flashed like a beacon halfway up the slope, before disappearing again behind a rock. Realising that, red hair or no, he could easily lose Jem in the rugged landscape, Roger lengthened his stride. Ought he to call out? He knew approximately where the cave was. Brianna had described its location to him, but he hadn't yet been up there himself. It occurred to him to wonder how Jem knew where it was. Perhaps he didn't, and was searching for it. Still, he didn't call, but started up the hill himself. Now he came to look, he could see the narrow path of a deer trail through the growth, and the partial print of a small sneaker in the mud of it. He relaxed a little at the sight and slowed down. He wouldn't lose Jem now. It was quiet on the hillside, but the air was moving, restless in the rowan trees.
The heather was a haze of rich purple in the hollows of the soaring rock above him. He caught the tang of something on the wind and turned after it, curious. Another flash of red. A stag, splendidly antlered and reeking of rut, 10 paces from him on the slope below. He froze, but the deer's head came up, wide black nostrils flaring to scent the air. He realized suddenly that his hand was pressed against his belt, where he'd once carried a skinning knife, and his muscles were tensed, ready to rush down and cut the deer's throat once the hunter's shot took it down. He could all but feel the tough, hairy skin, the pop of the windpipe, and the gush of hot, reeking blood over his hands, see the long, yellow teeth exposed, slimed with the green of the deer's last meal. The stag belled, a guttural, echoing roar, his challenge to any other stag within hearing. For the space of a breath, Roger expected one of Ian's arrows to whirr out of the rowans behind the deer or the echo of Jamie's rifle to crack the air. Then he shook himself back into his skin and, bending, picked up a stone to throw. But the deer had heard him and was off with a crash that took it rattling into the dry bracken. He stood still, smelling his own sweat, still dislocated. But it wasn't the North Carolina mountains. And the knife in his pocket was meant for cutting twine and opening beer bottles. His heart was pounding, but he turned back to the trail, still fitting himself back into time and place. Surely it got easier with practice. They'd been back well more than a year now, and still he woke, sometimes at night, with no notion where or when he was, or worse, stepped through some momentary wormhole into the past while still awake. The kids, being kids, hadn't seemed to suffer much from that sense of being otherwhere. Mandy, of course, had been too young and too sick to remember anything, either of her life in North Carolina or the trip through the stones. Jem remembered. But Jem, he'd taken one look at the automobiles on the road they'd reached half an hour after their emergence from the stones on Ocracoke, and stood transfixed, a huge grin spreading across his face as the cars whizzed past him. Vroom, he'd said contentedly to himself. The trauma of separation and time travel. Roger had himself barely been able to walk, feeling that he had left a major and irretrievable piece of himself trapped in the stones. Apparently forgotten. A kindly motorist had stopped for them, sympathised with their story of a boating accident, and driven them to the village, where a collect phone call to Joe Abernathy had sorted out the immediate contingencies of money, clothes, a room, and food. Jem had sat on Roger's knee, gazing open-mouthed out the window as they drove up the narrow road, the wind from the open window fluttering his soft, bright hair. Couldn't wait to do it again. And once they'd got settled at Lallybroch, had pestered Roger into letting him drive the Morris Minnie round the farm tracks, sitting in Roger's lap, small hands clenching the steering wheel in glee. Roger smiled wryly to himself. He supposed he was lucky Jem had decided to abscond on foot this time. Another year or two, and he'd likely be tall enough to reach the pedals. He'd best start hiding the car keys. He was high above the farm now, and slowed to look up the slope. Brianna had said the cave was on the south face of the hill, about 40 feet above a large whitish boulder known locally as Leap o' the Cask. So known because the Dunbonnet's servant, bringing ale to the hidden laird, had encountered a group of British soldiers, and, refusing to give him the cask he carried, had had his hand cut off. "Oh, Jesus," Roger whispered. "Fergus. Oh, God, Fergus." Could see at once the laughing, fine-boned face, dark eyes snapping with amusement as he lifted a flapping fish with the hook he wore in place of his missing left hand. And the vision of a small, limp hand lying bloody on the path before him. Because it was here. Right here. Turning, he saw the rock, big and rough, bearing silent, stolid witness to horror and despair, and to the sudden grip of the past that took him by the throat, fierce as the bite of a noose.
He coughed hard, trying to open his throat, and heard the hoarse, eerie bell of another stag close above him on the slope, but still invisible. He ducked off the trail, flattening himself against the rock. Surely to God he hadn't sounded bad enough that the stag had taken him for a rival. No, more likely it was coming down in challenge to the one he'd seen a few moments before. Sure enough, an instant later, a big stag came down from above, picking its way almost daintily through heather and rocks. It was a fine animal, but was already showing the strain of rutting season, its ribs shadowed under the thick coat, and the flesh of its face sunk in, eyes red with sleeplessness and lust. It saw him. The big head swiveled in his direction, and he saw the rolling, bloodshot eyes fix on him. It wasn't afraid of him, though. Likely had no room in its brain for anything save fighting and copulation. It stretched its neck in his direction and belled at him, eyes showing white with the effort.
Look, mate. You want her? You can have her.
He backed slowly away, but the deer followed him, menacing him with lowered antlers. Alarmed, he spread his arms, waved and shouted at the deer. Normally that would have sent it bounding away. Red deer in rut weren't normal. The thing lowered its head and charged him. Roger dodged aside and threw himself flat at the base of the rock. He was wedged as tightly next the rock's face as he could get, in hopes of keeping the maddened stag from trampling him. It stumbled to a stop a few feet from him, thrashing at the heather with its antlers and breathing like a bellows. But then it heard the blatting of the challenger below and jerked its head up. Another roar from below, and the new stag turned on its haunches and bounded clear over the trail, the sound of its hell-bent passage down the slope marked by the crunch of breaking heather and the rattle of stones spurned by its hooves. Roger scrambled to his feet, adrenaline running through his veins like quicksilver. He hadn't realized the red deer were at it up here, or he'd not have been wasting time strolling along, maundering about the past. He needed to find Jem now, before the boy ran afoul of one of the things. He could hear the roars and clashing of the two below, fighting it out for control of a harem of hinds, though they were out of sight from where he stood.
Jem!
He bellowed, not caring whether he sounded like a rutting deer or a bull elephant.
Jem, where are you? Answer me this minute.
I'm up here, da.
Jemmy's voice came from above him, a little tremulous, and he whirled to see Jem sitting on the leap of the cask, string bag clutched to his chest.
Right, you. Down. Now.
Relief fought with annoyance, but edged it out. He reached up, and Jem slid down the rock, landing heavily in his father's arms. Roger grunted and set him down, then leaned down to pick up the string bag which had fallen to the ground. In addition to bread and lemon squash, he saw it held several apples, a large chunk of cheese, a packet of chocolate biscuits.
"Planning to stay for a while, were you?"
he asked. Jemmy flushed and looked away. Roger turned and looked up the slope.
Up there, is it? Your granddad's cave?
He couldn't see a thing. The slope was a jumble of rock and heather, liberally splotched with scrubby gorse bushes, and the odd sprout of rowan and alder.
Aye, just there.
Jemmy pointed up the slope.
See where that witch tree's leaning?
He saw the rowan. A full-grown tree, gnarled with age, surely it couldn't have been there since Jamie's time, could it? But still saw no sign of the cave's opening. The sounds of combat from below had ceased. He glanced round in case the loser should be coming back this way, but evidently not.
Show me, he said.
Jem, who had been looking deeply uneasy, relaxed a little at this, and turning, scrambled up the slope, Roger at his heels. You could be right next to the cave's opening and never see it. It was screened by an outcrop of rock and a heavy growth of gorse. You couldn't see the narrow opening at all unless you were standing in front of it. A cool breath came out of the cave, moist on his face. He knelt down to peer in, couldn't see more than a few feet inside, but it wasn't inviting. be cool to sleep in there, he said. He glanced at Jem and motioned to a nearby rock. Want to sit down and tell me what happened at school? Jem swallowed and shifted from foot to foot.
No.
Sit down.
He didn't raise his voice, but made it evident he expected to be obeyed. Jem didn't quite sit down, but edged backward, leaning against the rocky outcrop that hid the cave mouth. He wouldn't look up.
I got the strap, Jem muttered, chin buried in his chest.
Who?
Roger kept his voice casual.
Well, that's a bugger. I got it once or twice when I was at school. Didn't like it.
Jem's head jerked up, eyes wide.
Aye? What for, then?
Fighting, mostly, Roger said.
He supposed he oughtn't to be telling the boy that bad example, but it was the truth. And if fighting was Jem's problem...
That what happened today?
He'd looked Jem over briefly when he sat down and gave him a closer look now. Jem seemed undamaged, but when he turned his head away, Roger could see that something had happened to his ear. It was a deep crimson, the lobe of it nearly purple. He suppressed an exclamation at the sight of it and merely repeated,
What happened?
Jackie McEnroe said if she heard I got the strap, he'd give me another whipping when I got home.
Jem swallowed, but now looked at his father directly.
Will you?
I don't know. I hope I won't have to.
He'd tossed Jemmy once. He'd had to, and neither of them wanted to repeat the experience. He reached out and touched Jem's flaming ear gently.
Tell me what happened, son.
Jem took a deep breath, blowing out his cheeks, then deflated into resignation.
Aye. Well, it started when Jimmy Glasscock said Mam and me and Mandy were all going to burn in hell.
Yeah?
Roger wasn't all that surprised. Scottish Presbyterians weren't known for their religious flexibility, and the breed hadn't altered all that much in 200 years. Manners might keep most of them from telling their papist acquaintance they were going straight to hell, but most of them likely thought it.
Well,
you know what to do about that, though, don't you?
Jem had heard similar sentiments expressed on the ridge, though generally more quietly, Jamie Fraser being who he was. Still, they talked about it, and Jem was well prepared to answer that particular conversational gambit.
Oh, aye.
Jem shrugged, looking down at his shoes again.
Just see. Aye, fine. I'll see you there, then. I did.
And?
Deep sigh.
I said it in the Gaelic.
Roger scratched behind his ear, puzzled. Gaelic was disappearing in the Highlands, but was still common enough that you heard it once in a while in the pub or the post office. No doubt a few of Jem's classmates had heard it from their grands, but even if they didn't understand what he'd said...
And, he repeated.
And Miss Clendenin grabbed me by the ear and like to tore it off.
A flush was rising in Jemmy's cheeks at the memory.
She shook me, da.
By the ear?
Roger felt an answering flush in his own cheeks.
Yes.
Tears of humiliation and anger were welling in Jem's eyes, but he dashed them away with a sleeve and pounded his fist on his leg.
She said, We do not speak like that. We speak English.
His voice was some octaves higher than the redoubtable Miss Glendinning's, but his mimicry made the ferocity of her attack more than evident.
And then she took a strap to you?
Roger asked incredulously. Jem shook his head and wiped his nose on his sleeve.
No, he said. That was Mr. Mingus.
What? Why? Here.
He handed Jem a crumpled paper handkerchief from his pocket and waited while the boy blew his nose.
Well, I was already fast wee Jimmy. When she grabbed me like that, it hurt bad. And, well, my dander got up,
he said, giving Roger a blue-eyed look of burning righteousness that was so much like his grandfather that Roger nearly smiled despite the situation.
And you said something else to her, did you?
Aye.
Jem dropped his eyes, rubbing the toe of his sneaker in the dirt.
Miss Glendunning doesn't like the Gaelic, but she doesn't know any either. Mr. Mengus does.
Oh, God.
Drawn by the shouting, Mr. Mengus had entered into the play yard just in time to hear Jem give Miss Glendunning the benefit of some of his grandfather's best Gaelic curses at the top of his lungs.
So, he made me bend over a chair, gave me three good ones, and sent me to the cloakroom to stay till school was out.
Only you didn't stay there.
Jem shook his head, bright hair flying. Roger bent and picked up the string bag, fighting back outrage, dismay, laughter, and a throat-clutching sympathy. On second thought, he let a bit of the sympathy show.
Running away from home, were you?
No.
Jem looked up at him, surprised.
Didn't I want to go to school tomorrow, though? Not and have Jimmy laugh at me. So I thought to stay up here till the weekend, and maybe by Monday things would get sorted. Miss Glendinning might die, he added hopefully.
And maybe your mam and I would be so worried by the time you came down, you'd get off without a second whipping.
Jem's deep blue eyes widened in surprise.
Oh, no! Mum would give me lalde if I just went off with no word. I put a note on my bed. Said I was living rough a day or two.
He said this with perfect matter-of-factness. Then he wiggled his shoulders and stood up, sighing.
Can we get it over and go home?
He asked, his voice trembling only a little.
I'm hungry.
I'm not going to whip you, Roger assured him.
He reached out an arm and gathered Jemmy to him.
Come here, pal.
Jemmy's brave facade gave way at that, and he melted into Roger's arms, crying a little in relief, but letting himself be comforted, cuddling like a puppy against his father's shoulder, trusting Da to make it all right.
And his Da bloody would, Roger promised silently, no matter if he had to strangle Miss Glendinning with his bare hands.
Why is it bad to speak Gaelic, Da?
He murmured, worn out by so much emotion.
I didn't mean to do anything bad.
It's not,
Roger whispered, smoothing the silky hair behind Jem's ear.
Dinna fash yourself. Mam and I will get it sorted, I promise. And you haven't got to go to school tomorrow.
Jem sighed at that, going inert as a bag of grain. Then he lifted his head and gave a small giggle.
Do you think Mam will give Mr. Mingus lolly?
Chapter 27 Tunnel Tigers. Brianna's first intimation of disaster was the slice of light on the track shrinking to nothing in the split second it took for the enormous doors to swing shut, echoing behind her with a boom that seemed to shiver the air in the tunnel. She said something that she would have washed Jem's mouth out for saying, and said it with heartfelt fury, but said it also under her breath, having realised in the instant that it took the doors to close what was happening. She couldn't see a thing save the swirls of colour that were her retina's response to sudden dark, but she was only 10 feet or so inside the tunnel and could still hear the sounds of the bolts sliding home. They were worked by big wheels on the outside of the steel doors and made a grinding sound like bones being chewed. She turned carefully, took 5 steps, and put out her hands. Yes, there were the doors, big, solid, made of steel, and now solidly locked. She could hear the sound of laughter outside.
Giggling,
she thought with furious contempt, like little boys. Little boys, indeed. She took a few deep breaths, fighting off both anger and panic. Now that the dazzle of the darkness had faded, she could see the thin line of light that bisected the 15-foot doors. A man-height shadow interrupted the light,
but was jerked away to the accompaniment of whispers and more giggling. Someone trying to peek in, the idiot. Good luck to him, seeing anything in here. Aside from the hair of light between the doors, the hydroelectric tunnel under Loch Erochty was dark as the pits of hell. At least she could use that hair of light for orientation. Still breathing with deliberation, she made her way, stepping carefully. She didn't want to amuse the baboons outside any more than necessary by stumbling and falling noisily, to the metal box on the left wall where the power switches that controlled the tunnel lighting were located. She found the box and was momentarily panicked to find it locked, before recalling that she had the key. It was on the big jangle of grubby keys that Mr. Campbell had given her, each one dangling a worn paper tag with its function written on. Of course she couldn't read the bloody tags, and frigging Andy Davies had casually borrowed the flashlight that should have been in her belt on the pretext of looking under the truck for an oil leak. They'd planned it pretty well, she thought grimly, trying one key, then the next, fumbling and scratching to insert the tip in the tiny invisible slot. All three of them were clearly in on it. Andy, Craig McCarty, and Rob Cameron. She was of an orderly mind, and when she tried each key in careful turn with no result, didn't try them again. She knew they'd thought of that one, too. Craig had taken the keys from her to unlock the toolbox in the panel truck and returned them with a bow of exaggerated gallantry. They'd stared at her, naturally, when she was introduced to them as the new safety inspector, though she supposed they'd already been informed she was that shocking thing, a woman. Rob Cameron, a handsome young man who clearly fancied himself, had looked her frankly up and down before extending his hand with a smile. She'd returned the slow up and down before taking it, and the other two had laughed. So had Rob, to his credit. She hadn't sensed any hostility from them on the drive to Loch Erochty, and she thought she'd have seen it if it had been there. This was just a stupid joke. Probably. In all honesty, the doors closing behind her had not been her first intimation that something was up, she thought grimly. She'd been a mother much too long to miss the looks of secretive delight or preternatural innocence that marked the face of a male up to mischief. And such looks had been all over the faces of her maintenance and repair team, if she'd spared the attention to look at them. Her mind had been only half on her job, though. The other half had been in the 18th century, worried for Fergus and Marsali, but encouraged by the vision of her parents and Ian, safely bound at last for Scotland. But whatever was going on, had gone on, she corrected herself firmly, in the past. She had other things to worry about in the here and now. What did they expect her to do, she wondered? Scream? Cry? Beat on the doors and beg to be let out? She walked quietly back to the door and pressed her ear to the crack, in time to hear the roar of the truck's engine starting up and the spurt of gravel from its wheels as it turned up the service road. "You bloody bastards," she said out loud. "What did they mean by this?" Since she hadn't satisfied them by shrieking and crying, they decided simply to leave her entombed for a while, come back later in the hopes of finding her in shards, or better yet, red-faced with fury. Or, more sinister thought, did they mean to go back to the hydroelectric board office, innocent looks on their faces, and tell Mr. Campbell that his new inspector simply hadn't shown up for work this morning? She breathed out through her nose, slow, deliberate. Right. She'd eviscerate them when the opportunity offered, but what to do just now? She turned away from the power box, looking into the utter black. She hadn't been in this particular tunnel before, though she'd seen one like it during her tour with Mr. Campbell. It was one of the original tunnels of the hydroelectric project, dug by hand, with pick and shovel, by the hydro boys back in the 1950s. It ran nearly a mile through the mountain and under part of the flooded valley that now held the greatly expanded Loch Erochty, and a toy-like electric train ran on its track down the centre of the tunnel. Originally, the train had carried the workmen, the tunnel tigers, to the work face and back. Now reduced only to an engine, it served the occasional hydroelectric workers checking the huge cables that ran along the tunnel's walls, or servicing the tremendous turbines at the foot of the dam, far off at the other end of the tunnel. Which was, it occurred to her, what Rob, Andy and Craig were meant to be doing, lifting one of the massive turbines and replacing its damaged blade. She pressed her back against the tunnel wall, hands flat on the rough rock, and thought. That's where they'd gone, then. It made no difference, but she closed her eyes to improve her concentration and summoned up the pages of the massive binder, presently on the seat of the vanished truck that contained the structural and engineering details of all the hydroelectric stations under her purview. She'd looked at the diagrams for this one last night, and again hastily while brushing her teeth this morning. The tunnel led to the dam, and had obviously been used in the construction of the lower levels of that dam. How low? If the tunnel joined at the level of the turbine chamber itself, it would have been walled off. But if it joined at the level of the servicing chamber above, a huge room equipped with the multi-ton ceiling cranes needed to lift the turbines from their nests, then there would still be a door. There would have been no need to seal it off, with no water on the other side. Try as she might, she couldn't bring the diagrams to mind in sufficient detail to be sure there was an opening into the dam at the far end of the tunnel. But it would be simple enough to find out. She'd seen the train in that brief moment before the doors closed. It didn't take much fumbling round to get into the open cab of the tiny engine. Now, had those clowns taken the key to the engine too? Ha! There was no key. It worked by a switch on the console. She flipped it, and a red button glowed with sudden triumph as she felt the hum of electricity run through the track beneath. The train couldn't have been simpler to run. It had a single lever, which you pushed forward or back, depending on which direction you meant to go. She shoved it gently forward and felt air move past her face as the train moved silently off into the bowels of the earth. She had to go slowly. The tiny red button shed a comforting glow over her hands, but did nothing to pierce the darkness ahead, and she had no idea where or how much the track curved. Neither did she want to hit the end of the track at a high rate of speed and derail the engine. It felt as though she was inching through the dark, but it was much better than walking, feeling her way over a mile of tunnel lined with high-voltage cables. It hit her in the dark. For a split second, she thought someone had laid a live cable on the track. In the next instant, a sound that wasn't a sound thrummed through her, plucking every nerve in her body, making her vision go white. And then her hand brushed rock, and she realized that she had fallen across the console, was hanging halfway out of the tiny trundling engine, was about to fall out into darkness. Head spinning, she managed to grab the edge of the console and pull herself back into the cab, flipped the switch with one shaking hand, and half fell to the floor, where she curled up, gripping her knees, her breath a whimpering in the dark. "Holy God," she whispered. "Oh, blessed mother, oh, Jesus!" She could feel it out there, still feel it. It didn't make a sound now, but she felt its nearness and couldn't stop trembling. She sat still for a long time, head on her knees, until rational thought began to come back. She couldn't be mistaken. She'd passed through time twice and knew the feeling. But this hadn't been nearly so shocking. Her skin still prickled, and her nerves jumped, and her inner ears rang as though she'd thrust her head into a hive of hornets. But she felt solid. She felt as though a red-hot wire had sliced her in two, but she hadn't had the horrible sense of being disassembled, turned physically inside out. A terrible thought sent her surging to her feet, clinging to the console. Had she jumped? Was she somewhere... somewhen else? But the metal console was cool and solid under her hands, the smell of damp rock and cable insulation unchanged.
No,
she whispered, and flicked the power light for reassurance. It came on, and the train, still in gear, gave a sudden lurch. Hastily, she throttled back the speed to less than a crawl. She couldn't have jumped into the past. Small objects in direct contact with a traveller's person seemed to move with them, but an entire train in its track was surely pushing it. Besides, she said out loud, if you'd gone more than 25 years or so into the past, the tunnel wouldn't be here. You'd be inside solid rock. Her gorge rose suddenly, and she threw up. The sense of it was receding, though. It, whatever it was behind her. Well, that settled it, she thought, wiping her mouth with the back of her hand. There bloody well had to be a door at the far end, because there was no way she was going back the way she'd come. There was a door. A plain, ordinary, industrial metal door. And a padlock, unlocked, hanging from an open hasp. She could smell WD-40. Someone had oiled the hinges very recently. And the door swung open easily when she turned the knob. She felt suddenly like Alice after falling down the White Rabbit's hole. A really mad Alice. A steep flight of steps lay on the other side of the door, dimly lit, and at the top was another metal door edged with light. She could hear the rumble and the metallic whine of a ceiling crane in operation. Her breath was coming fast, and not from the effort of climbing the stairs. What would she find on the other side? It was the servicing chamber inside the dam, she knew that much. But would she find Thursday on the other side? The same Thursday that she'd had when the tunnel doors had closed behind her. She gritted her teeth and opened the door. Rob Cameron was waiting, lounging back against the wall, lit cigarette in hand. He broke into an enormous grin at sight of her, dropped the butt, and stepped on it. "Knew you'd make it, Hen," he said. Across the room, Andy and Craig turned from their work and applauded. "Buy you a pint after work, then, lass," Andy called. "Two," shouted Craig. She could still taste bile at the back of her throat. She gave Rob Cameron the sort of look she'd given Mr. Campbell. "Don't," she said evenly, "call me Hen." His good-looking face twitched, and he tugged at his forelock with mock subservience. "Anything you see, boss," he said. Chapter 28 Hilltops. It was nearly 7 by the time he heard Brianna's car in the drive. The kids had had their supper, but came swarming out to her, clinging to her legs as though she'd just come back from darkest Africa or the North Pole. It was some time before the kids were settled for the night, and Bree had time to give her undivided attention to him. He didn't mind. "Are you starving?" she said. "I can fix." He interrupted her, taking her by the hand and drawing her into his office, where he carefully closed and locked the door. She was standing there, hair half matted from her hard hat, grimy from spending the day in the bowels of the earth. She smelled of earth. Also engine grease, cigarette smoke, sweat, and beer?
"I've a lot to tell you," he said, "and I know you've a lot to tell me. But first, could you just slip off your jeans, maybe? Sit on the desk and spread your legs?"
Her eyes went perfectly round.
"Yes," she said mildly. "I could do that."
Roger had often wondered whether it was true what they said about red-headed people being more volatile than the usual, or whether it was just that their emotions showed so suddenly and alarmingly on their skins. Both, he thought. Maybe he should have waited till she'd got her clothes on before telling her about Miss Glendinning. If he had, though, he'd have missed the remarkable sight of his wife, naked and flushed with fury from the navel upward.
"That bloody old bism! If she thinks she can get away with—"
"She can't," he interrupted firmly. "Of course she can't.
You bet she can't. I'll go down there first thing tomorrow and...
Well, maybe not.
She stopped and looked at him, one eye narrowed. Maybe not what?
Maybe not you.
He fastened his own jeans and picked hers up.
I was thinking it might be best if I go.
She frowned, turning that one over.
Not that I think you'd lose your temper and set about the old bitch, he added, smiling. But you have got your job to go to, aye?
Hmm, she said, seeming sceptical of his ability to adequately impress Miss Glendenning with the magnitude of her crime.
And if you did lose the heed, and not the woman, I'd hate to have to explain to the kids why we were visiting Mummy in jail.
That made her laugh, and he relaxed a little. He really didn't think she'd resort to physical violence, but then she hadn't seen Jemmy's ear right after he'd come home. He'd had a strong urge himself to go straight down to the school and show the woman what it felt like, but he was in better command of himself now. So, what do you mean to say to her? She fished her brassiere out from under the desk, giving him a succulent view of her rear aspect, as she hadn't put the jeans on yet.
Nothing. I'll speak to the principal. He can have a word with her.
Well, that might be better, she said slowly. We don't want Miss Glendenning to take it out on Jemmy.
Right.
The beautiful flush was fading. Her hard hat had rolled off under the chair. He picked it up and set it on her head again.
So, how was work today? And why don't you wear knickers to work?
He asked, suddenly remembering. To his startlement, the flush roared back like a brush fire. I got out of the habit in the 18th century, she snapped, plainly taking the huff. I only wear knickers for ceremonial purposes anymore. What do you think? I was planning to seduce Mr. Campbell?
Well, not if he's anything like you described him. No, he said mildly. I just noticed when you left this morning, I wondered.
Oh. She was still ruffled, he could see that, and wondered why. He was about to ask again about her day, when she took the hat off and eyed him speculatively. You said if I wore the hat, you'd tell me what you were doing with that champagne bottle. Other than giving it to Mandy to throw through the window, she added with a tinge of wifely censoriousness. What were you thinking, Roger?
Well, in all honesty, I was thinking about your arse, he said. But it never occurred to me that she'd throw the thing, or that she could throw it like that.
Did you ask her why she did it? He stopped, nonplussed.
It hadn't occurred to me that she'd have a reason, he confessed. I snatched her off the table as she was about to pitch face first into the broken window, and I was so frightened that I just picked her up and smacked her bum.
I don't think she'd do something like that for no reason, Bree said meditatively. She'd put aside the hard hat and was scooping herself into her brassiere, a spectacle Roger found diverting under just about any circumstances. It wasn't until they'd gone back to the kitchen for their own late supper that he remembered to ask again how her workday had gone. Not bad, she said, with a good assumption of casualness. Not so good as to convince him, but good enough that he thought better of prodding, and instead asked,
Ceremonial purposes?
A broad grin spread across her face. You know, for you.
Me?
Yes, you and your fetish for women's lacy underthings.
What? You mean you only wear knickers for...
For you to take off, of course. There was no telling where the conversation might have gone from this point, but it was interrupted by a loud wail from above, and Bree disappeared hastily in the direction of the stairs, leaving Roger to contemplate this latest revelation. He'd got the bacon fried and the tinned beans simmering by the time she reappeared, a small frown between her brows. Bad dream, she said, in answer to his lifted brow. The same one.
The bad thing trying to get in our window again.
She nodded and took the saucepan of beans he handed her, though she didn't move immediately to serve out the food.
I asked her why she threw the bottle.
Aye.
Brianna took the bean spoon, holding it like a weapon. She said she saw him outside the window.
Him? The
Nucklevy. In the morning, the broch was just as it had been the last time he'd looked. Dark, quiet, save for the rustling of the doves overhead. He'd taken away the rubbish. No new fish papers had come. Swept and garnished, he thought, waiting for the occupation of whatever roaming spirit might happen by. He shook that thought off and closed the door firmly. He'd get new hinges and a padlock for it next time he passed by the farm and household stores. Had Mandy really seen someone? And if she had, was it the same tramp who had frightened Jem? The idea of someone hanging round spying on his family made something hard and black curl through his chest like a sharp-pointed iron spring. He stood for a moment, narrowly surveying the house, the grounds, for any trace of an intruder. Anywhere a man might hide. He'd already searched the barn and the other outbuildings. The Dunbonnet's cave. The thought, with his memory of Jem standing right by the mouth of the cave, chilled him. Well, he'd soon find out, he thought grimly, and with a last glance at Annie MacDonald and Mandy peacefully hanging out the family washing in the yard below, he set off. He kept a sharp ear out today. He heard the echo of the red stags belling still hard at it, and once saw a small herd of hinds in the distance, but luckily met no lust-crazed males. No lurking tramps, either. It took him some time of casting about to find the cave's entrance, even though he'd been there only the day before. He made a good bit of noise approaching, but stood outside and called,
"Hello! The cave!"
just in case. No answer. He approached the entrance from the side, pressing back the covering gorse with a forearm, ready in case the tramp might be lurking inside. But he could tell, as soon as the damp breath of the place touched his face, that it was unoccupied. Nonetheless, he poked his head in, then swung himself down into the cave itself. It was dry for a cave in the Highlands, which wasn't saying all that much. Cold as a tomb, though. It was no wonder Highlanders had a reputation for toughness. Anyone who wasn't would have succumbed to starvation or pneumonia in short order. Despite the chill of the place, he stood for a minute, imagining his father-in-law here. It was empty and cold, but oddly peaceful, he thought. No sense of foreboding. In fact, he felt welcomed, and the notion made the hairs prickle on his arms.
"Grant, Lord, that they may be safe," he said quietly, his hand resting on the stone at the entrance.
Then he climbed out into the sun's warm benediction. That strange sense of welcome, of having been somehow acknowledged, remained with him.
"Well, what now, Ahar Kela?" he said aloud, half joking.
Even as he said it, he realized that he was looking. On the top of the next small hill was the heap of stones Brianna had told him about. Human-made, she'd said, and thought it might be an Iron Age fort. There didn't look to be enough of whatever it was standing to offer shelter to anyone, but out of sheer restlessness, he made his way down through the tumble of rock and heather, splashed through a tiny burn that gurgled through the rock at the foot of the hill, and toiled his way up to the heap of ancient rubble. It was ancient, but not as old as the Iron Age. What he found looked like the ruins of a small chapel. A stone on the ground had a cross chiselled crudely into it, and he saw what looked like the weathered fragments of a stone statue scattered by the entrance. There was more of it than he'd thought from a distance. One wall still reached as high as his waist, and there were parts of two more. The roof had long since fallen in and disappeared, but a length of the roof tree was still there, the wood gone hard as metal. Wiping sweat from the back of his neck, he stooped and picked up the statue's head. Very old. Celtic? Pictish? Not enough left to tell even the statue's intended gender. He passed a thumb gently over the statue's sightless eyes, then set the head carefully atop the half wall. There was a depression there, as though there might once have been a niche in the wall.
Okay, he said, feeling awkward. See you later, then.
And turning, made his way down the rough hill toward home, still with that odd sense of being accompanied on his way.
The Bible says, seek, and ye shall find, he thought,
and said aloud to the vibrant air,
but there's no guarantee about what you'll find, is there?
Chapter 29 Conversation with a Headmaster. After a peaceful lunch with Mandy, who seemed to have forgotten all about her nightmares, he dressed, with some care, for his interview with the headmaster of Jem's school. Mr. Mingus was a surprise. Roger hadn't thought to ask Bree what the man was like, and had been expecting something squat, middle-aged, and authoritarian, along the lines of his own headmaster at school. Instead, Mingus was close to Roger's own age, a slender, pale-skinned man with spectacles, and what looked like a humorous eye behind them. Roger didn't miss the firm set of the mouth, though, and thought he'd been right to keep Bree from coming.
Lionel Mingus, the headmaster said, smiling.
He had a solid handshake and a friendly air, and Roger found himself revising his strategy.
Roger Mackenzie.
He let go and took the proffered seat across the desk from Mingus.
Jeremiah's dad. Oh, aye, of course. I rather thought I might see you or your wife when Jem didn't turn up at school this morning.
Mingus leaned back a little, folding his hands.
Before we go very far, could I just ask exactly what Jem told you about what happened?
Roger's opinion of the man rose a grudging notch.
He said that his teacher heard him say something to another lad in the Gaelic, whereupon she grabbed him by the ear and shook him. That made him mad, and he called her names, also in Gaelic, for which you belted him.
He'd spotted the strap itself, hung up inconspicuously, but still quite visible, on the wall beside a filing cabinet. Mingus's eyebrows rose behind his spectacles.
Is that not what happened? Roger asked,
wondering for the first time whether Jem had lied, or omitted something even more horrible from his account.
No, that's what happened, Mingus said. I've just never heard a parent give such a concise account. Generally speaking, it's a half hour of prologue, dissociated trivia, contumely and contradiction. That's if both parents come. And personal attacks before I can make out precisely what the trouble is. Thank you.
He smiled. And quite involuntarily, Roger smiled back.
I was sorry to have to do it, Mingus went on, not pausing for reply. I like Jem. He's clever, hard-working, and really funny. He is that, Roger said, but I hadn't a choice, really.
Mingus interrupted firmly.
If none of the other students had known what he was saying, we might have done with a simple apology. But... did he tell you what it was he said? Not in detail, no.
Roger hadn't inquired. He'd heard Jamie Fraser curse someone in Gaelic only 3 or 4 times, but it was a memorable experience, and Jem had an excellent memory.
Well, I won't either then, unless you insist. But the thing is, while only a few of the kids on the play yard likely understood him, they would tell, well, they have told, in fact, all their friends exactly what he said. And they knew I understood it too. I've got to support the authority of my teachers. If there's no respect for the staff, the whole place goes to hell. Did your wife tell me you'd taught yourself? At Oxford, I think she said. That's very impressive. That was some years ago, and I was only a junior don, but yes... And to hear what you're saying, though I unfortunately had to keep order and respect without the threat of physical force.
Not that he wouldn't have loved to be able to punch one or two of his Oxford second-year students in the nose. Mingus eyed him with a slight twinkle.
I'd say your presence was likely adequate, he said, and given that you're twice my size, I'm pleased to hear that you're not inclined to use force.
Some of your other parents are?
Roger asked, raising his own brows.
Well, none of the fathers has actually struck me, no, though it's been threatened once or twice. Did have one mother come in with a family shotgun, though.
Mingus inclined his head at the wall behind him, and looking up, Roger saw a spray of black pockmarks in the plaster, mostly, but not entirely, covered by a framed map of Africa.
Fired over your head, at least,
Roger said dryly, and Mingus laughed.
Well, no, he said, deprecating. I asked her, please, to set it down carefully, and she did, but not carefully enough. Caught the trigger somehow, and blam! The poor woman was really unnerved, though not quite as much as I was.
You're bloody good, mate,
Roger said, smiling in acknowledgement of Mingus's skill in handling difficult parents, including Roger. But leaning forward a little to indicate that he meant to take control of the conversation.
But I'm not yet anyway, complaining about your belting, Jem. It's what led to that.
Mingus drew breath and nodded, setting his elbows on the desk and steepling his hands.
Aye, right. I understand the need to support your teachers,
Roger said, and set his own hands on the desk.
But that woman nearly tore my son's ear off, and evidently for no crime greater than saying a few words, not cursing, just words, in the Gaelic.
Mingus's eyes sharpened, catching the accent.
Ah, you've got it then. Wondered, Ken, was it you or your wife had it? You make it sound like a disease. My wife's an American, surely you noticed.
Mingus gave him an amused look. No one failed to notice Brianna, but said only,
Aye, I noticed. She told me her da was Scots, though, and a Highlander. Do you speak it at home? No, not much. Jem got it from his granda. He's no longer with us, he added.
Mingus nodded.
Ah, he said softly. Aye, I had it from my grandparents as well. My mam's folk, dead too now. They were from Skye.
The usual implied question hovered, and Roger answered it.
I was born in Kyle of Lochalsh, but I grew up mostly in Inverness. Picked up most of my own Gaelic on the fishing boats in the Minch.
He thought,
and in the mountains of North Carolina.
Mingus nodded again, for the first time looking down at his hands rather than at Roger.
Been on a fishing boat in the last 20 years? No, thank God.
Mingus smiled briefly, but didn't look up.
No, you won't find much of the Gaelic there these days. Spanish, Polish, Estonian. Quite a bit of those, but not the Gaelic. Your wife said you'd spent a number of years in America, so you'll maybe not have noticed, but it's not much spoken in public anymore. To be honest, I hadn't paid it much mind. Not till now.
Mingus nodded again, as though to himself, then took off his spectacles and rubbed at the marks they'd left on the bridge of his nose. His eyes were pale blue, and seemed suddenly vulnerable without the protection of his glasses.
It's been on the decline for a number of years, much more so for the last 10-15 years.
The Highlands are suddenly part of the UK, or at least the rest of the UK says so, in a way they've never been before, and keeping a separate language is seen as not only old-fashioned, but outright destructive. It's know what you'd call a written policy to stamp it out, but the use of Gaelic is strongly discouraged in schools. Mind?
He raised a hand to forestall Roger's response.
They couldn't get away with that if the parents protested, but they don't. Most of them are eager for their kids to be part of the modern world, speak good English, get good jobs, fit in elsewhere,
be able to leave the Highlands. Not so much for them here, is there, save the North Sea?
The parents?
If they've learned the Gaelic from their own parents, they deliberately don't teach it to their kids. And if they haven't got it, they certainly make no effort to learn. It's seen as backward, ignorant, very much a mark of the lower classes.
Barbarous, in fact, Roger said with an edge. The barbarous Erse.
Mingus recognised Samuel Johnson's dismissive description of the tongue spoken by his 18th century Highland hosts, and the brief, rueful smile lit his face again.
Exactly. There's a great deal of prejudice, much of it outspoken against
Tuchters.
Tuchter was a Lowland Scots term for someone in the Gaeltacht, the Gaelic-speaking Highlands, and in cultural terms, the general equivalent of hillbilly or trailer trash.
Oh, you do know then? Something.
It was true, even as recently as the 60s, Gaelic speakers had been viewed with a certain derision and public dismissiveness. But this... Roger cleared his throat.
Regardless, Mr. Mingus, he said,
calming down a bit on the Mr.
I object very much to my son's teacher not only disciplining him for speaking Gaelic, but actually assaulting him for doing so. I share your concern, Mr. Mackenzie, Mingus said, looking up and meeting his eyes in a way that made it seem as though he truly did. I've had a wee word with Miss Glendenning, and I think it won't happen again.
Roger held his gaze for a moment, wanting to say all sorts of things, but realising that Mingus was not responsible for most of them.
If it does, he said evenly, I won't come back with a shotgun, but I will come back with a sheriff and a newspaper photographer to document Miss Glendenning being taken off in handcuffs.
Mingus blinked once and put his spectacles back on.
You're sure you wouldn't rather send your wife round with a family shotgun? He asked wistfully.
And Roger laughed, despite himself.
Fine, then.
Mingus pushed back his chair and stood up.
I'll see you out. I've got to lock up. We'll see Jem on the Monday, then, will we? You'll be here, with or without handcuffs.
Mingus laughed.
Well, he needn't worry about his reception, since the Gaelic-speaking kids did tell their friends what it was he said, and he took his belting without a squeak. I think his entire form now regards him as Robin Hood or Billy Jack.
Oh, God.
Chapter 30. Ships That Pass in the Night. May 19th, 1777. The shark was easily 12 feet long, a dark, sinuous shape keeping pace with the ship, barely visible through the storm-stirred grey waters. It had appeared abruptly just before noon, startling me badly when I looked over the rail and saw its fin cut the surface.
What's amiss with its head?
Jamie, appearing in response to my startled cry, frowned into the dark water.
It has a growth of some sort.
I think it's what they call a hammerhead. I clung tight to the railing, slippery with spray. The head did look misshapen, a queer, clumsy, blunt thing at the end of such a sinisterly graceful body. As we watched, though, the shark came closer to the surface and rolled, bringing one fleshy stalk and its distant cold eye momentarily clear of the water. Jamie made a sound of horrified disgust. They normally look like that, I informed him.
Why?
I suppose God was feeling bored one day. That made him laugh, and I viewed him with approval. His colour was high and healthy, and he'd eaten breakfast with such appetite that I'd felt I could dispense with the acupuncture needles. What's the strangest thing you've ever seen? An animal, I mean. A non-human animal, I added, thinking of Dr. Fentiman's ghastly collection of pickled deformities and natural curiosities.
Strange by itself. Not deformed, I mean. But has God meant it to be?
He squinted into the sea, thinking, then grinned.
The Mandrill and Louis of France's zoo? Or, well, no, maybe a rhinoceros, though I haven't seen one of those in the flesh. Does that count?
Let's say something you've seen in the flesh, I said, thinking of a few pictorial animals I'd seen in this time that appeared to have been deeply affected by the artist's imagination. You thought the mandrill was stranger than the orangutan? I recalled his fascination with the orangutan, a solemn-faced young animal who had seemed equally fascinated by him, this leading to a number of jokes regarding the origins of red hair on the part of the Duc d'Orléans, who had been present.
Nay, I've seen a good many people who look stranger than the orangutan, he said.
The wind had shifted, yanking auburn lashings of hair out of his ribbon. He turned to face into the breeze and smoothed them back, sobering a little.
I felt sorry for the creature. It seemed to Ken it was alone and might never see another of its kind again.
Maybe it did think you were one of its kind, I suggested. It seemed to like you.
It was a sweet wee thing, he agreed. When I gave it an orange, it took the fruit from my hand like a Christian, very mannerly. Do you suppose...
His voice died away, his eyes going vague. Do I suppose?
Oh, I was only thinking.
He glanced quickly over his shoulder, but we were out of earshot of the sailors.
What Roger and Max said about France being important to the revolution. I thought I should ask about when we're in Edinburgh, see whether there might be any of the folk I knew who had fingers in France.
He lifted one shoulder. You aren't actually thinking of going to France, are you? I asked, suddenly wary.
No, no, he said hurriedly. I only happen to think, if by some chance we did, might the orangutan still be there? It's been a great while, but I dinna ken how long they live.
Not quite as long as people, I don't think, but they can live to a great age if they're well cared for, I said dubiously. The doubt was not all on the orangutan's account. Go back to the French court. The mere thought made my stomach flip-flop.
He's dead, Ken,
Jamie said quietly. He turned his head to look at me, eyes steady.
Louis.
Is he? I said blankly. When? He ducked his head and made a small noise that might have been a laugh.
He died 3 years ago, Sassenach, he said dryly. It was in the papers. Though I grant you the Wilmington Gazette didn't make a great deal of the matter.
I didn't notice. I glanced down at the Sharp, still patiently keeping company with the ship. My heart, after the initial leap of surprise, had relaxed. My general reaction, in fact, was thankfulness. And that in itself surprised me, rather. I'd come to terms with my memory of sharing Louis's bed, for the 10 minutes it had taken, long since. And Jamie and I had long since come to terms with each other, turning to each other in the wake of the loss of our first daughter, Faith, and all the terrible things that had happened in France before the rising. It wasn't that hearing of Louis's death made any real difference at all, but still, I had a feeling of relief, as though some tiresome bit of music that had been playing in the far distance had finally come to a graceful end, and now the silence of peace sang to me in the wind. God rest his soul, I said, rather belatedly. Jamie smiled and laid his hand over mine.
God rest his soul,
he echoed.
Makes you wonder, Ken. How might it be for a king to come before God and answer for your life?
Might it be a great deal worse, I mean, having to answer for all the folk under your care? Do you think he would? I asked, intrigued, and rather uneasy at the thought. I hadn't known Louis in any intimate way, bar the obvious, and that seemed less intimate than a handshake. He'd never even met my eyes, but he hadn't seemed like a man consumed by care for his subjects. Can a person really be held to account for the welfare of a whole kingdom? Not just his own peccadilloes, do you think? He considered that seriously, the stiff fingers of his right hand tapping slowly on the slippery rail.
"I think so," he said. "You'd answer for what you'd done to your family, no? Say you'd done ill by your children, abandoned them or left them to starve. Surely that would weigh against your soul, for you're responsible for them. If you were born a king, then you're given responsibility for your subjects. If you do ill by them, then..."
"Well, but where does that stop?" I protested. "Suppose you do well by one person and badly by another. Suppose you have people under your care, so to speak, and their needs are in opposition to one another. What do you say to that?" He broke into a smile.
"I'd say I'm very glad I'm not God, and have no got to try to reckon such things."
I was silent for a moment, imagining Louis standing before God, trying to explain those 10 minutes with me. I was sure he'd thought he had a right. Kings, after all, were kings. But on the other hand, both the 7th and the 9th commandments were fairly explicit and didn't seem to have any clauses exempting royalty. "If you were there," I said impulsively, "in heaven, watching that judgment, would you forgive him?" "I would."
"Who?" he said, surprised. "Louis?"
I nodded, and he frowned, rubbing a finger slowly down the bridge of his nose. Then he sighed and nodded.
"Aye, I would. Wouldn't have mind watching him squirm a bit first, mind," he added darkly. "A wee pitchfork in the earth would be fine."
I laughed at that, but before I could say anything further, we were interrupted by a shout of "Sail ho!" from above. While we'd been alone the instant before, this advice caused sailors to pop out of the hatches and companionways like weevils out of a ship's biscuit, swarming up into the rigging to see what was up. I strained my eyes, but nothing was immediately visible. Young Ian, though, had gone aloft with the others, and now landed on the deck beside us with a thump. He was flushed with wind and excitement.
"A smaller ship, but she's got guns!"